From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the quandary we face in Iraq. Journalist James Fallow says the U.S. can't honorably leave Iraq until it has a viable security force. But our troops can't sensibly stay when the presence of our troops is a rallying point for insurgents. Fallow's article, Why Iraq Has No Army, is the cover story of the December issue of The Atlantic. Also, we talk with the Kitchen Sisters about collecting sounds and voices that capture the world we live in and the world of the past. Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson produced the NPR series Lost and Found Sound, the Sonic Memorial Project, and Hidden Kitchens. Now they have a Hidden Kitchens book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, the Senate voted by a 4-1 margin to ask for quarterly reports from the Bush administration on progress in Iraq. The proposal states that, quote, 2006 should be a period of significant transition to full Iraqi sovereignty, unquote. In other news connected to the war, over the weekend, American troops discovered a secret detention center in the basement of Iraq's Interior Ministry building where the detainees were allegedly tortured. Interior Ministry officials reported that the torturers appear to have been police officers. My guest James Fallow says it will be difficult for the U.S. to pull out of Iraq until Iraq has a reliable security force, but they're not even close. Fallows wrote the cover story for the December issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called Why Iraq Has No Army. Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. James Fallows, welcome back to Fresh Air. In your story, you say that you think we're basically in an impossible situation. Would you describe the quandary that you think we're in?
The quandary we're in involves the presence of U.S. troops in Iraq. On the one hand, everybody now acknowledges, concedes, warns about the fact that the very presence of those troops is an irritant in Iraq and is one source, not the only source, but one source of the continued insurgency, the continued violence, including the fact that those troops are themselves targets. And one of the things which is very desired by the insurgents is to kill as many Americans as they have. So on the one hand, the American troops can't really stay there. On the other hand, they can't really go because now 2.5 years after the fall of Baghdad, the elimination of Saddam Hussein, there really is not any other force for order or even such order as exists in Iraq now other than the U.S. military and some few allied forces, mainly British. So the dilemma is we can't stay and we can't go. The way out of the dilemma, allegedly and desirably, would be the creation of a native Iraqi security force. But why that's difficult is the main thing I was trying to look at in this article.
And before we get to why that's difficult, what do you think the consequences would be if we decided, well, it's just too difficult to stay and, you know, there's so many attacks against the military now, so we will just go? What would the consequences be?
Well, if you look long into the future, you know, 10 years from now, 50 years from now, you would assume that one way or another this would sort itself out for Iraqis. And if they are to be one country, which historically they've only been, you know, for a relatively recent time of history, but if they are to be one country one way or another in terms of ethnic balances, military pressures, democratic institutions or non-democratic institutions, they'll work it out in the shorter term in which we all live, which is to say the next year or 2 years or 5 years. I think there's a wide assumption the country would essentially break into with the famous three components, with the Kurdish component, the Shiite and Sunni regions. And the reason that would matter to the U.S., apart from just the carnage that might be involved for the people there, is that the central Sunni district, which is the heart of the insurgency now, it is assumed will become essentially an insurgent-controlled, warlord-controlled, sort of tyrannical-type region that would have as its main reason for being an outright enemy of the United States. What was the role that Afghanistan played under the Taliban before September 11th as a haven for terrorists is what it is assumed this Sunni stan would play if the country just broke apart.
One of the reasons why it's difficult for us to pull out of Iraq now is because there isn't a strong military or a police force to maintain order in Iraq. It was the Coalition Provisional Authority that dismissed most or all of the Iraqi military. What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, this is going to be historically one of the hotly debated issues about the Iraq War. We're all familiar with the debates about, you know, WMD intelligence and all the rest. But I think when military historians and diplomatic historians look at this war, they're going to spend a lot of time looking at this question of why one of the first things that Ambassador Bremer did as the head of the new Coalition Provisional Authority was to get rid of the Iraqi army. Before the war, the Bush administration had planned to keep the Iraqi military in place, stripping off, you know, just the generals and commanders, some of the generals and commanders, on the argument that while these people had some disadvantages, they were associated with brutality in Saddam Hussein, they had the advantage of being a force in place, some force for order. They had their own transportation. They could do some good in the reconstruction. So on a narrow basis, the administration decided they would work with this pre-existing army, sort of as had been done in Germany or Japan, where you strip off the very top layer of real bad guys and deal with the average soldiers. As a side note, one complication in stripping off the top layer of the Iraqi army is that it had about 10,000 generals in it. The U.S. Army, which has about the same number of troops, has 300 generals. The Iraqi army had 10,000 generals. So that's a whole separate question. After the invasion of Iraq and the fall of Baghdad, there was, you know, widespread disorder. And the judgment on the ground by Bremer's people was there was no more structure in place. You know, the barracks had been looted. They'd been emptied out. And so their judgment was the pre-existing advantages were no longer there. And so they might as well just, you know, recognize the disadvantages and clean house and start over.
What was the argument against dismissing them?
The main argument against this step of dismissing the Iraqi army is that you instantly created a hostile class. These were people who suddenly had no paycheck, but who still had their weapons and now had a motivation to be against the U.S. occupation. So everything was suddenly became harder once you had these cashiered soldiers in the country.
What are some of the reasons your sources in the military told you were having such a hard time training the Iraqi military and Iraqi police? On the one hand, it seems like it shouldn't be that big a deal. You know, you train them, they learn, they do their job.
Well, there's sort of an ascending series of difficulties, starting with the fact that training an actual professional army is a very hard thing. You know, the United States military spends years and years and years trying to develop an officer corps, and it has all these graduate schools, and it thinks it's going to take a long time to shape people's careers. And even creating your ordinary Marine, to the extent that's not an a self-contradiction, or your ordinary Army soldier, is regarded as a real effort of changing some. It's not simply teaching people skills. It's sort of changing their identity. They go in as civilians and they come out as Marines, or they come out as soldiers. So doing this in a country where the starting point of the military culture was entirely different was a real shift. And the pre-existing Iraqi military under Saddam Hussein had officers who were largely parasites, and it had ordinary troops who were largely cannon fodder. And in between, it did not have the crucial element that actually makes the U.S. military work, which are the NCOs, the non-commissioned officers, the sergeants, you know, who the grizzled sergeants who make everything operate. So trying to create that was one problem. Just creating a military would be difficult in any circumstance. Then you have the situations in Iraq itself where you have all the famous ethnic tensions and the fact that the main effective force were the Kurdish militias and to a degree the Shiite militias. So having some national identity was tough. Then just to kind of cut off the list at three or four rather than 20 items, there were incentives inside the U.S. military. Historically, training duties on the whole have not been really for the A team in the military. There are exceptions like the Special Forces and the Green Berets, which do a lot of training work. But generally, the combat commands are the glamour commands, and the training commands are the less glamorous commands. So there was not that much emphasis before the war and the early occupation within the U.S. side of really putting a lot of emphasis, a lot of talent, a lot of pizzazz on the training missions.
You mentioned that a lot of the people in the military are part of factions. You know, they're Kurdish, they're Shiite. They have an ethnic identity above and beyond Iraqi. So are the ethnic differences that we're seeing in Iraq in general reflected in the army, and is that holding back the military from being a really well-functioning military?
There has been a distinct effort, especially in the last year by the U.S., to try to have not purely ethnically defined military units and to have as many sort of combined units as they have and to post people outside their home region, although that creates all kinds of tensions when you have, you know, Sunni troops in a Shiite area, et cetera. So there's emphasis on being it more nationally Iraqi and less purely ethnic than it used to be. But certainly, as was described to me, the essential nature of most of these troops is still regional. One man I talked to, Robert Pape of the University of Chicago, who wrote a great book on suicide terrorism, was saying the way to imagine this would be as if the victorious Union forces had gone into the South after the Civil War and tried to have units of white and black Southerners fighting side by side. You had, you know, 200-plus years of history making that difficult for the U.S. and so too in Iraq.
Now, your military sources told you that we're doing a better job training the military in Iraq now than we were early after the invasion. What are we doing different?
Part of the difference seems to be a simple increase in emphasis at the personnel level. A man named David Petraeus, a lieutenant general in the Army, who is one – at each era of military history, there's a handful of people who are sort of the obvious high flyers or fast movers. And he has been one of those. He was the commander of the 101st Airborne during the actual war. In the summer of last year, he took over command of the training mission. And since he himself was so obviously a man on the rise within the military, this was taken as an important sign that, this was a more important mission. He's been able to shift a number of the tactics and strategy for the training. Just to give two examples, the main measure or metric, as they say in the military, for how the Iraqis were doing, it used to be things as crude as how many people were on the rolls, which included a lot of ghost soldiers, or how many were so-called trained and equipped. And under Petraeus, this had been shifted to a unit readiness or unit capability measure in four brackets. There's much more emphasis on having American advisors be connected for a long time or embedded with Iraqi forces, and a number of other sort of nuts and bolts sorts of things, which are having an improving trend on the Iraqi force.
But some of the people who told you that also told you, but it's too late.
It's in an ultimate sense, you know, it may or may not be too late, and just in a no, there's no hope sense. But what they did say is that as the situation of training Iraqi troops has been getting better, the surrounding situation has been getting worse and getting worse faster, and the troops are improving. So by a measure of the gap that there is to fill for Iraqi forces, the whole effort is falling behind because the situation is getting worse faster than the Iraqis are being prepared to deal with it.
Can we talk about this and say, well, who knew? Who knew that it would be this hard to train the Iraqi military and a security force? And who knew that there would be an insurgency? Do you feel like you knew?
In the summer of 2002, which is to say 9 months before the combat began, I was finishing an article for The Atlantic sort of interviewing people who'd run past occupations. And this was published as an article called The 51st State. And all of them said then that for a very, very short time, the U.S. is going to be seen as a liberator, and it'll become an occupier. Language will be a problem. Dealing with the existing Iraqi army will be a problem. The ethnic tensions, of course, will be a problem. Keeping social order after these years of oppression is going to be a problem. So before the war, there were all sorts of people that I, as an average unclassified journalist, was able to talk to. After the war began, I was able to re-interview a larger set of people who showed me the actual documents, again, not classified, but saying there were sort of prescriptions and checklists and plans of all the things that the administration should have been aware of because its own people were preparing these reports in the months before the war and the early months of the occupation. So I think one could claim that the whole WMD controversy involved things that nobody really knew for sure. But the maintenance of order, it's very much harder to make that case because lots of people should have known that problems were ahead.
My guest is James Fallows. He wrote the cover story for the December issue of The Atlantic. It's called Why Iraq Has No Army. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist James Fallows, and he has the cover story in the new December issue of The Atlantic Monthly, and it's called Why Iraq Has No Army. Now, I want to get back to what you were saying before, that you talk to all these experts. You, a journalist without access to classified sources, talk to all these experts who warned you that, you know, who shared their warnings that the problems that we're now facing, we would be facing. So did you ever ask members of the Bush administration their reaction to these warnings that you were getting from other experts? And what did they tell you? Warnings that there'd be an insurgency, warnings that it would be hard to keep order, that it would be hard to train the military.
I wish I could speak with more authority about the Bush administration's answer to these criticisms or more firsthand authority. The unfortunate reality is that since 2002, I haven't been able to get interviews from people in the positions of political authority, although I've spoken to more and more military people. In January of 2002, I interviewed Paul Wolfowitz, and in the fall, I spoke to Doug Feith, but nobody at the top since then. What I understand from inference and reporting and off-the-record conversations and all the rest is essentially this. Number one, the administration would say, oh, sure, it's easy to second guess. You know, if you look at the horoscopes, you'll find anything predicted you can come up with. And so it's irresponsible to go back through the record and say people warned against X, Y, and Z. What about all the things they warned against that didn't happen? The answer to that, of course, is there was a consensus of the main bodies, the CIA, the Army War College, lots of other people, about what the main problems would be. I think the other main theme that's come from the administration is there was one big thing that they failed to prepare for. It wasn't WMD, it wasn't the looting, it wasn't things like that. They didn't realize, as they now see it, that Saddam Hussein all along had been planning an insurrection. All along, in their view now, he'd been planning to sort of play possum and then have his bitter enders come up and lead the kind of insurgency that's underway now. But there's certainly been no indication in public statements by anybody in the administration that they regret anything about the occupation.
Well, you say you've had trouble talking to members of the Bush administration. You've spoken to a lot of military leaders, but many of the people who, not all, but many of the people you quote are anonymous. And why do you think they feel they need to remain anonymous?
This has been, I should say, a really bitter pill for me, or a bitter bargain, because something I've tried very hard to do in lo these many decades of writing about this kind of issue is to name the people I am quoting. And I've taken pride in having few or no unnamed sources in most of the stories I wrote. What's been impressive or striking to me in the last 2 or 3 years is that with each passing month, it's been easier to talk with people in the military, but harder to be able to quote them by name. Easier to talk with them because I think there is a sense of concern, disaffection, whatever you want to call it, among people in the military about the way things have been going for their institution and in Iraq. At the same time, you can't quote them by name because the sense of lines being drawn and authorized and unauthorized statements, that's become clearer and clearer. So I'm able to quote in this article a few general officers and colonels who were authorized by the Pentagon to speak with me, but a large number of people with whom I've been maintaining email correspondences while they're in Baghdad, while they're in Fallujah, while they're in Tikrit, saying, you know, here's what's been going on, but I can't quote them by name.
We've been talking a little bit about why Iraq has why their army was basically dismissed and how difficult it's been to train an Iraqi army and police force. You are puzzling through a question that, you know, Congress has been debating and America in general has been debating, England has been debating, which is, so what do we do now? Do we pull out? Do we stay? If we stay, for how long? If we pull out, what kind of timetable do we present? You've thought this through. In your personal opinion, what do you think we should do?
Well, I don't pretend to have an answer that eludes the rest of the civilized world on this front. What I do try to add to the discussion is this degree of clarity. I ended up thinking that there really was a pretty stark choice that we face, that if we want to constitute an Iraqi force that is capable of preserving order in that country so that we can leave in an honorable fashion, by which I mean not with civil war immediately on our heels, not with mass ethnic slaughter immediately following our withdrawal, something at least as decent as the withdrawal from Vietnam. That's my standard, where there were sort of 2 years where the South Vietnamese army was able to hold off the North Vietnamese. If that is our goal, it's going to take a very long time to do that. That even if all the training plans for the Iraqi army go as planned, it's going to be many, many years before they have air support sufficient to their needs. That is both airplanes and helicopters. It's going to be a very long time before the intelligence systems the U.S. has are adequate. All sorts of other logistics factors. So if this is to happen, it will require quite a long-term commitment and also a different sort of human commitment. One real problem in the training exercises so far has been the one-year rotation period for Americans. We have a sort of a presence of continual fresh faces because they're taken in and out. Americans now stay there too long for their own good, but not long enough for the training mission. So it would mean having more people there for a longer period of time, more people who are trained linguists, all sorts of other serious commitments. So on the one hand, making this work in the way that we envision of a decent departure from Iraq, I think, will mean facing a commitment through the next presidential term, whoever comes after George Bush, to be there in a serious way. Not as many soldiers as now, but quite a few. If we're not willing to face that serious commitment, it seems to me, we should face the fact that we cannot leave there honorably. and we're going to leave dishonorably. And so if that's the case, then we might as well do it sooner rather than later. But that, to me, that's the main thing I want to add. It seems to me that clear a choice.
What do you think the debate is like within the Bush administration about this? Do you have any idea?
I wish I knew. I wish there were signs of two things. One is signs that the president himself exposed himself or sought out really contending points of view. For example, on the question of whether Iraq has helped or hurt in the larger effort against terrorism, as far as I've been able to tell, there's no indication that the president himself has ever wrestled with that idea. You know, he has often stated, you know, time and again that Iraq and the war on terrorism are inseparable and the same. It would be nicer to think that he had come to that conclusion after some debate than just coming to that conclusion. As a side note here, I love listening to the C-SPAN tapes on the weekend of Lyndon Johnson's conversations. And Lyndon Johnson, I mean, the taped recordings of LBJ. It was obvious that man was tormented over Vietnam. Signs of a president being tormented over this difficult situation might be worse for him, but more reassuring to the country. I guess the other thing I would like to see from the Bush administration is some sign that they're addressing the serious challenges to their Iraq policy. What we get is a lot of responses to straw men. You know, some people say we should cut and run. Some people say the Iraqis aren't worth it. Having them actually address the serious complaints about their policy would be a welcome thing. But I don't know what they're actually saying to each other.
Well, James Fallows, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His article, Why Iraq Has No Army, is the cover story of the December edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, featuring Secrets of the Widow's Son by David Shugarts, a look at the upcoming sequel to The Da Vinci Code. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lost and Found Sound, the Sonic Memorial Project, and Hidden Kitchens. We talk with the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, about searching for sounds and voices for their NPR series. They have a new book adapted from their Hidden Kitchen series. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Kitchen Sisters have searched America for the sounds and voices that capture our time and the recent past. They describe their work as chronicling the hidden parts of history, the traditions and rituals that people carry with them. The Kitchen Sisters, who aren't really sisters, are Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. In conjunction with Jay Allison, they've produced the NPR series Lost and Found Sound, the Sonic Memorial Project, and Hidden Kitchens. They've won 2 Peabody Awards. Now they have a new book called Hidden Kitchens, adapted from their radio series. Hidden Kitchens isn't so much about food itself as it is about the meaning of food in people's lives and how people get together around food. The Kitchen Sisters searched for stories, as they often do, by asking NPR listeners to call with their suggestions.
Message 23 was received at 1:10 p.m. today.
I'm Margaret Engel. A woman who works for Legal Aid was talking to me about how many of her clients get dinner. The people who struggle to even get food on the table because they don't have an official kitchen and who are using George Foreman grills and the like. The George Foreman grill has been an amazing success story as a kitchen appliance, but what I think many people don't realize is that immigrants and low-income people have contributed to that popularity. That is, to me, the epitome of the hidden kitchen.
Wow. What a wonderful story. I'd never considered it at all. I'm George Foreman, two-time heavyweight champion of the world, former Olympic champion, and king of the grills. Growing up in Houston, Texas, my whole life was spent trying to get enough to eat. Having seven kids, my mother did, and there just was never enough food for me. I always dreamed about not a car, not a beautiful home, but enough to eat.
My name, Piggly Wiggly. I've got groceries on my shelf.
My name is Jeffrey Newton, Chicago. I'm a great cook. A trait that I had learned from my grandmother, but I just haven't had a kitchen. I'm living in a shelter at this particular time, but I've been homeless all my life. I lived under Wacker Drive, where the expressway goes through, and there's about 30 or 40 refrigerator boxes down there. That's going to be your home. I would get a George Foreman grill. That's the grill that I had for a while under Wacker Drive, me and a fellow by the name of Smokey. So you just get your long extension cord. Well, they got a lot of electrical plugs on the poles down there. And just hook up. We was making hamburgers.
Nikki Silva, Davia Nelson, welcome to Fresh Air. Real pleasure to have you on our show. The George Foreman story is such a wonderful story. I mean, I never would have considered that people who are homeless can cook food with the help of a Foreman grill, or like how useful an electric grill is if you're living in an SRO. But let me back up a little bit here. How did you first come up with the idea for Hidden Kitchens?
Well, Davia lives in San Francisco, and she hates to drive. She takes taxi cabs every place. And she started noticing that all these cab drivers, particularly in the yellow cab company, were Brazilian. And, you know, she started talking with them, and, of course, they talked about food and music and... Whenever they talked about food, this woman, Jeanette, came up in the conversation, and it turns out that there was this woman who was from their same hometown, Goiânia. All these guys are from Goiânia. And this woman from Goiânia would set up each night in the cab yard outside the yellow cab company, set up a blue tent, and cook the food of their hometown. And the men would come, and pretty soon other cab drivers started to come, and she was just sort of gathering her community like a campfire, and these men were finding home and community through her cooking. And so we headed down there to see what that was all about. It sounded like a real Kitchen Sisters kind of story. And we just began to think, if Jeanette is doing this here with music and people and language and community, then who else is out there? And it sort of got us thinking about little hidden kitchen economies in the rest of the country and what was happening on street corners and how were things changing and who were the unsung kitchen heroes that were bringing their communities together. And that's how it was born.
As with some other projects that you've done, you found people by putting the word out on All Things Considered that you were looking for people who had these hidden kitchens. Then you asked them to call and leave a message on an answering machine. Have you found this technique to be, you know, really effective, putting the word out on the radio and then waiting for people to call in?
Absolutely. Somehow the answering machine is sort of almost like this natural microphone. People know how to talk into a phone. It's not intimidating. And people love to give you the lowdown, the secret, the thing below the radar, something only they know about, whether it's some extraordinary old piece of tape that they have or some little hidden kitchen that they know about that's tucked away or some kitchen ritual that's just theirs or their communities. And somehow the way that phone line works, just thousands of people keep calling it and wanting to spill the beans.
Do you get a lot of crank calls and obscene calls?
You know, remarkably few. More we get product people. They think, For your Hidden Kitchen series now, we have knives. We have a special folding table. I mean, when you hear those kind of messages, we also get a lot of people have, my dissertation is on the tradition of pierogies in the basements of Polish halls in an upper section of Ohio, accessible only by cattle car. You know, I mean, things so obscure, but so heartfelt. And so a lot of people sort of are pitching their unpublished novels.
In your Hidden Kitchens book, you say that you think food is really about fellowship. And of course, who could argue with that? But I was wondering, do you like to eat alone too? And do you guys ever eat alone, either at home or in a restaurant?
Me? I don't like to eat alone. This is Nikki. I'd rather not eat.
Really? Why is that?
I don't know. I think I just take a lot more pleasure out of the conversation and the making of it than actually even the eating of it for me.
Well, Nikki lives on a commune. You should know that, Terry. So she's lived on a commune for 27 years. So when Nikki sits down to dinner, there are three families there, and they cook one night a week each. And she's eating on an epic level every single evening.
And Devia, what about you? Do you eat alone ever?
Sometimes I eat alone. Yeah, I actually like eating alone. I like eating with people more, absolutely. And I like eating, you know, I'm out a lot on the road doing these stories, so a lot of the times I'm eating by myself there. And something about being alone, you may start out at the table alone, but you're almost never alone by the end of it.
Something I am. Happens. I'm always alone at the end of it. Just like me and my newspaper or my book.
Really, I pick up strays. I don't know. There's something. I'm sort of always scanning the perimeter. And
Davia's parents taught her to talk to strangers.
Yeah, I think that's true. And my father, from when I was really little, brought me into the back of restaurants to show me. There was this one Italian restaurant in L.A. that he loved because it reminded him of New York, where he was from, and Little Italy. And so he was always bringing me as a little girl into the back of it. So I think somewhere I didn't learn about those boundaries, the places and restaurants you're not supposed to go. And I don't know, there's always a good story back there somewhere.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the Kitchen Sisters. That's Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. And I'm sure you've heard a lot of their pieces on National Public Radio on All Things Considered in Morning Edition. And their new book, Hidden Kitchens, is a collection of stories and recipes from their Hidden Kitchens NPR series. And there's also an audiobook version with the actual pieces in them. Let's talk a little bit about an earlier series that you did, Lost and Found Sound. And why don't you describe what the series was?
It was a series that we created at the turn of the century for the millennium. And we turned to the country and we said, we're looking for how sound has shaped history and history's been shaped by sound, people possessed by sound, sound on the verge of extinction. How is the soundtrack of America changing, vanishing voices, shifting accents? And that was the first time we opened up that phone line on NPR. And we said to the nation, this was a big collaboration with All Things Considered, with independent producers, with artists from all kinds of mediums, with musicians, you name it. Everyone was involved with that project. So some 1,500 people worked on it. Anyway, we opened up this phone line and people all around the country sent in stories and recordings. And we set out, there are 92 stories now in the Lost and Found Sound collection.
You know, in your Lost and Found Sound series, there's a combination of like rare archival recordings from well-known people, you know, important cultural and historical figures. And there's also just kind of found recordings, like ephemeral recordings that weren't even supposed to last, made at penny arcades and made on home cassette machines and that we don't even have the means to play back because the playback versions, the playback technology for these recordings barely exists anymore. But so you know, it's this wonderful mix of, you know, unprofessional recordings of every sort. What got you interested in that kind of recording?
Well, we were doing a live radio program. That's how Davia and I started working together 25 years ago on a little community radio station in Santa Cruz, California, KUSP. And we did this live show, which was music and interviews and very eclectic. Filmmakers would come through town and we'd interview filmmakers and writers. And we were searching for old recordings. You know, we'd played a lot of old jazz, and my dad has had this notorious garage where everything you could ever want was in this garage. And when we started doing this show, he said, well, you know, we've got some 78s in the garage, your mom's 78s. So we hauled this huge box of 78s back to the station and started going through them. And one of the records was in a plain brown wrapper, and it was just handwritten, "To Louie, Love, Mrs. B." And it was a 78 recording. We put it on, and it was this woman, Mrs. B, and we still don't know who she is, and my father doesn't know who she is. His name's Ernie, not Louie. And we put this on, and it was a woman in her kitchen using a home recording machine, which were popular during the 40s and 50s, and she was talking to her husband, who was overseas during World War II. And there was just something about this woman's voice and her use of language and words, you know. "Do they jitterbug over there, Louie? Gee, Lou, they don't dance as good as we do. Do they, hun?" I mean, just a sort of anxiousness and love and concern. And, you know, "We'll ski in 43. Gee, Lou, I hope so." There was something about this woman's voice that just captured all these things we'd read about. But, you know, how do you portray that in words? I mean, it was her voice. It was her soul coming through her voice that really caught us. And we began asking around. And almost everybody we talked to had some home recording in their attic or in their stereo console or something tucked away, that an old recording that their family had done. You know, my mother had done one at the boardwalk in Santa Cruz. She said she used to sing like, she thought she sang like Ella Fitzgerald. You know, she'd get in there and just sing away. So we began gathering these things, and we just found, wow, what a window, what an ear into the past these recordings were. And that was the beginning. We began on that little radio show, sort of exploring that avenue, and that really came through. It's come through in all the stuff we've done since.
My guests are Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, the Kitchen Sisters. Their new book, Hidden Kitchens, is adapted from their NPR series of the same name. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. They've collected sounds and voices from around the country for their NPR series Lost and Found Sound, the Sonic Memorial Project, and Hidden Kitchens. They have a new Hidden Kitchens book. I think you really found a kindred spirit in a way when you started working with Sam Phillips, the great Sam Phillips, who founded Sun Records and, you know, was the first to record Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis, Johnny Cash, Charlie Rich, Roy Orbison, and So you went down to talk with him, not about Sun Records, but about the era right before that, when he was running something called the Memphis Recording Service, which did what?
We record anything, anywhere, anytime. That was the slogan of the Memphis Recording Service. And that was his operation that sort of bankrolled everything else he was doing with all the musicians. It was just the bread and butter that kept him solvent, or barely solvent at the time. And he would go and record funerals and weddings and talent shows, anything you could think of, beauty contests. And he'd just show up with his tape recorder and convince people that they really wanted to get this documented. Then he'd print the records and he'd sell them to everybody who was in attendance.
Well, let's play an excerpt of the piece that you did about Sam Phillips. And he's talking here about why he wanted to record funerals for his Memphis Recording Service.
"Jehovah is my shepherd. He maketh me to lie down in green pasture."
To keep my little studio Memphis Recording Service open, I had to record many different things. Now, I went in as a very young man to talk to the manager of the National Funeral Home about recording funerals. Most people had never thought of anything like that. He wanted to know how in the world could people be approached at a time like that to make a recording. I told him that, Lord of mercy, I would under no circumstances interfere with quote-unquote whatever the flavor of the funeral was and the intimacy of it. How much more intimate could you be than to hear the minister or feel the crowd or if there's somebody that's crying or something like that? The sound made you smell it, taste it, feel it through your bones, your entire body. I mean, your soul. And when I got through talking to this man, I convinced him to let me record funerals. He gave me restrictions. I mean, the mic could not be in sight. I have hid it in little wreaths and sprays. Marion did one for me. I had to stand in Marion Keisker. I had gone out and set it up for her and everything. All she had to do was stay behind the curtain and turn the little recorder on. She said, Sam, how in the world did you ever think of... I said, well, if you are out of money, and I was looking for sources, frankly, to make money to do what I wanted to do.
That's Sam Phillips as recorded for Lost and Found Sound by the Kitchen Sisters, my guests, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. I feel like you really found a kindred spirit in him, because like hearing him talk about what the sound did, you know, the sound of the funeral made you taste it and feel it through your body to your soul. You feel that way about sound, don't you?
I think the best compliment we were ever given on the planet Earth was Sam Phillips saying, I think you know something about the acoustics of life. I mean,
oh,
Sam
so
Phillips.
Great.
Oh, it's this thing, if you know, it will be on the Kitchen Sister grave marker, I'll tell you. And he... you know, no matter, Sam Phillips for us was like going back to Thomas Edison. I mean, he was ground zero for sound of the century. When we first even imagined the idea of lost and found sound, Sam, we brought it to Sam Phillips, and he kind of gave us his blessing, and he gave us his time. And no matter what we were working on, he had some take on it that just sent us reeling and sent us spinning. And back and forth to Memphis for, ultimately, we did four stories out of there. He sold Sun Studios, you probably know this, he sold Elvis Presley's contract and opened up the first all-girl radio station in the nation in 1955. I mean, you know, the same guy that would record Rufus Thomas or B.B. King or Jerry Lee Lewis would imagine an all-girl station. This guy was just, he was lighting the path.
And one of the most interesting moments, I think, in the history of public radio conferences was when you brought Sam Phillips to the annual public radio conference, at which, you know, people from all the NPR stations used to meet and, you know, discuss NPR issues and programming and stuff. And there in the middle of this conference was like Sam Phillips. And it was this kind of like meeting of two worlds. And you were right in the middle. Like you were the intermediary between Sam Phillips and everybody else in public radio. What was that like for you to bring him to the conference?
He just grabbed the mic and ran. We had no way of knowing where he was going to go with it or what he was going to do. It was beautiful. It was inspirational.
Sam was on a wavelength of his own, and Sam was almost like a preacher. He was preaching the gospel of sound. He said to us, I can end wars with sound. And I think he just was on a mission with his music. When he opened his mouth, he was never going to stop. And I don't think public radio will ever be quite the same. We also had, because Memphis is the headquarters of FedEx, we had FedExed 400 pounds of ribs in from Memphis as well. So something about that smell of the ribs and Sam's stories. And then Sam's son, Knox, stood up in the midst of it, and he sort of testified. It was one of the more holy moments in public radio.
My guests are Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, the Kitchen Sisters. Their new book, Hidden Kitchens, is adapted from their NPR series of the same name. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guests are the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson. They've collected sounds and voices from around the country for their NPR series Lost and Found Sound, the Sonic Memorial Project, and Hidden Kitchens. They have a new Hidden Kitchens book. There's one other project I want to ask you about, and that's the project you did after September 11th, the Sonic Memorial Project. How did you figure out what you wanted to do to document the life and death of the World Trade Towers?
We thought, okay, we know what having voices means. We know what archival recordings mean to people, and we know what these little phone messages can mean. And we don't just mean the last words, not only that, those last recordings, but we called Verizon right after 9/11, a few days after 9/11, and we said, we know the towers went down, but usually voicemail isn't in the towers, isn't in the physical building, the same building as the telephones are. And we were thinking about all those thousands and thousands of voicemail messages. Some people would have perished, some people were still alive, but we just thought even the most mundane thing, like someone's voice saying, you know, meet me for lunch at 2 o'clock on Wednesday, let alone the final messages. And we thought if we could get those messages to the families of people from the buildings, that would be important to them. Somewhere having those little recordings, those most present recordings. So we got through finally to Verizon. Verizon said, yes, in fact, those messages still exist. And the automatic telephone janitoring system had kicked in. I guess this must have been about 10 days because you know how your messages get deleted after a certain amount of days. The first batch of messages had been deleted. And so we were sort of in this race against time. Somehow this became our way to connect, you know, how everyone wanted to do something. Anyway, Verizon worked with us and they... Anyone that wanted to get their a hard copy of the messages, because the voicemail system was down, they helped us to get those messages to family, the contents of those voicemail box. And then it led us to the idea of opening that phone line on NPR and asking people, and WNYC, they were extremely part of that project. And we just reached out around the country, but we said, let's not just contemplate 9/11, let's look into the whole recorded history of Lower Manhattan, and let's celebrate the life and acknowledge the history and honor the death and take a retrospective look of this piece of ground, this land, and look at the life and history through these archival recordings, and that led to the Sonic Memorial.
Well, let me play an excerpt of the Sonic Memorial Project, and we're going to hear a judge who married people at the top of the World Trade Center at Windows of the World, Windows on the World, and then we're going to hear somebody who actually got married there. Do you want to introduce this for us and tell us about these marriage ceremonies that took place there?
It was odd because it was one of the first stories that we aired, and it was so not what you would think of when you think of what had just happened at the Trade Towers, but I think it really resonated with people that this building had a history, it had a life, it was about love, it was about business, it was about daily life, and it wasn't just about the destruction. And in that way, I think this was an important piece.
Well, here's an excerpt of the piece that you did about people who got married at the top of the World Trade Center.
Welcome you to the World Trade Center. I'm Judge Frederick Berman, and it's my pleasure to be able to...
I'm Judge Frederick Berman. For many years, I've had the pleasure and privilege of performing weddings on Valentine's Day atop the World Trade Center. We did 3 an hour, every 20 minutes. They would put ads in papers around the country and abroad saying, if you are interested in getting married atop the World Trade Center on Valentine's Day, write us a letter and tell us why you would like to do it. The weddings that I actually performed, I have copies of all those letters so that I could personalize each of the ceremonies. The top cards are my notes. They met at the World Trade Center 2 years ago. He works in the food and beverage department.
My name is Enrique Mejia, and I work in the food and beverage department. I wrote that I just couldn't see myself getting married nowhere else but up here.
I was working downstairs as a tour guide. He was working up here. So it's like everything happened here. We got engaged last year about Valentine's. He called me over to the window to see the view, and then he just popped the question. And everybody from the food and beverage came with wine glasses and just started celebrating it.
My family's in Jersey, so my mother's talking about She's scared of elevators, so she wasn't coming. Her family's the same thing. They're scared of elevators, the heights. So we told them 107th floor. They was like, no, that's all right. When you finish, come see us.
That's an excerpt from the Kitchen Sisters piece about people who got married at the World Trade Center, part of their Sonic Memorial Project. When was that interview with the couple recorded? It almost sounds like it was recorded at the World Trade Center before it was attacked.
Yes, exactly. It wasn't a post. It was someone recording them when they were there for their wedding.
Oh, exactly. I see. It was actually recorded at the wedding.
Yes, exactly.
It's archival tape.
Yes, exactly. It's archival tape.
Oh, wow. That, mm-hmm. that makes it more, even more poignant.
Yeah, and when we were working on that series, we mm-hmm. had not been able to find them. So I was just thinking as I was listening, praying that they were hearing this, because we don't know what happened to them.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you so much.
The Kitchen Sisters have a new book called Hidden Kitchens. The audiobook version includes features from their NPR Hidden Kitchen series. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Joan Tui Westman, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Stalking the Puzzle Lady, a Puzzle Lady mystery by Parnell Hall, available in hardcover. And from the Freddie Mac Foundation, dedicated to creating hope and opportunity for foster children and a proud sponsor of National Adoption Day on November the 19th. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ted Koppel. Next Tuesday, he steps down from Nightline after anchoring the program for nearly 26 years. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.